loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held a press conference today as part of the historic summit in Hanoi. Next, former attorney for President Trump, Michael Cohen, testified in open session before the House Oversight Committee. Then, a series of airstrikes have dramatically escalated the conflict between India and Pakistan. And finally, President Maduro and U.S.-backed self-declared President Juan Guaido are continuing their struggle over the future of Venezuela. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has rejected the resignation of his foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and instructed him to continue in his current position. Zarif apparently offered his resignation in outrage after he was kept out of the loop regarding a surprise visit by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to Iran. His attempted resignation is also widely believed to be linked to intense domestic criticism over the nuclear deal signed with the United States and other world powers, which Zarif was a key architect of, but which has now been trashed by the Trump administration. Russia's Ministry of Defense today released a joint statement with the government of Syria, calling for the United States to pull its troops from Syria and to let buses safely relocate refugees at a camp in the Rukban area near the border with Jordan. President Trump has recently reversed his commitment to pull troops out of the country, announcing that 400 troops will stay in two parts of Syria. Senators introduced legislation yesterday to require the Director of National Intelligence to submit a public report of the incidents surrounding the death of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi after President Trump missed a deadline set by Congress to do the same. Khashoggi was killed after entering a Saudi consulate almost 6 months ago. The Independent National Electoral Commission of Nigeria announced that Muhammad Buhari has won a second term as that country's president. Buhari won 56% of the vote, according to the commission. However, Atiku Abubakar of the opposition People's Democratic Party has rejected the result, claiming that his campaign was the victim of vote rigging. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Hanoi and talks between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The two held a press conference today during which Trump said that he foresees a North Korea that is an economic powerhouse in East Asia. He added that he expects to make progress this week on outstanding issues between the two countries and repeated that he has an excellent personal relationship with Kim. The two followed up the press conference with a private dinner. We're joined from Hanoi by our own Brian Becker, who is there covering the summit. Good to have you back, Brian.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Brian, tell us what people are saying in Hanoi today about substantive issues. The press is abuzz here about the notion of the Korean War formally ending and maybe something substantive coming out of this short of a final denuclearization declaration.
Right. That's the rumor. If there is, again, as you mentioned, not a peace treaty per se, but a declaration signed by Kim Jong-un and President Trump announcing, in fact, declaring that the war between the U.S. and North Korea is over, that would be very large. And it's large because it speaks to what for North Korea is the precondition, and it would only be logical that it would be the precondition for any kind of denuclearization process that would ensue. Nobody would expect another country to disarm itself while in the middle of a war. So if the U.S. wants North Korea to begin the process of denuclearization, it has to end the war that began almost 69 years ago. So that is, in fact, the precondition. So that's the rumor. There may be other important parts to this meeting, though, which would be a schedule for what comes next after the declaration. What steps does North Korea need to take, or does the United States need to take, to show that denuclearization or some sort of disarmament mechanism is in motion on the Korean Peninsula? But let me start by also mentioning to you that after the press conference, as you alluded, they had a dinner. There was Donald Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un. To Donald Trump's left was Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, and Mike Pompeo, the secretary of state, an equal number on Kim Jong-un's part, including General Kim Jong-jol. He has been the chief negotiator, the interlocutor with Mike Pompeo over the past year and other top aides, including Kim Jong-un's sister. So all over Hanoi's TV today and tonight, images of this dinner were shown. You know, you can feel a suspense building here in Hanoi because even though there's been so many naysayers that this isn't going to work, that this is just platitudes, in fact, there could be real measurable progress.
What do you make of Donald Trump playing up the economic angle, the economic potentials for North Korea if these talks go well?
Well, you know, what Donald Trump is saying in this case is actually true. I mean, South Korea and North Korea together constitute a country of about 75 million people. That's larger than France or the UK. We could see that Vietnam, once unified, has taken off economically. There's great human resource potential in both South and North Korea, an industrious population, well-educated. If unified, yeah, it could be a real economic powerhouse. What's odd is they have this coming from the mouth of an American head of state, because it goes completely against the sort of basic thesis that North Korea is a basket case economically and must always be an economic basket case because it's led by a socialist government or a communist party-led government. So in many ways, Donald Trump, whether he knows it or not, is breaking a lot of the Washington taboos about how you're supposed to talk about North Korea. But could it be an economic powerhouse? Yes, I think it certainly could.
And Brian, you're there in Hanoi. There's thousands of people from all around the world who've traveled there to cover the summit. That includes journalists and activists. Tell us about the interview that you were able to conduct a little bit earlier on.
Yeah, it was very noteworthy. I had a chance to sit down with Christine Ahn. Christine is one of the founders of the Korea Policy Institute. She is also the executive director of Women Cross DMZ. She is a noteworthy, longtime, well-regarded, and very well-connected political activist. People in the U.S. Congress know Christine Ahn and her work to end the Korean War for a long time. So do people inside South Korea, including, I would say, at the top levels of the current South Korean government of Moon Jae-in. So what she has to say, I think, should be well-regarded. And what I asked her is, I said, Christine, we've been here before. 20 years ago, Bill Clinton seemed to be normalizing relations with North Korea. He dispatched Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, to Pyongyang. She came and met with Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father. It looked like the road towards normalization was ahead. But then Bill Clinton left office. George W. Bush came in, sabotaged that same process, declared North Korea to be an axis of evil. North Korea then left the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and began building nuclear bombs in earnest, and US-DPRK relations froze. So I asked her, if Donald Trump seems to be doing what Bill Clinton wanted to do 20 years ago, how does it keep going? What gives it a guarantee that it won't be short-lived? Let's listen to her response.
It's going to absolutely take a ratified agreement. And I think that's where it's going to be vital to have members of Congress, and especially progressive Democrats, who see the historic opportunity that we're in. And that the good news is that there is a congressional resolution that has been introduced today in Washington, D.C. by Congressman Ro Khanna, who was the leader in the stopping the U.S. war on Yemen. And Ro Khanna, Barbara Lee, and Andy Kim, who is the first Korean-American Democrat, I think, and so many women members of Congress, and not just the ones that were instrumental in the Iran deal, such as Jan Schakowsky from Chicago. She was a real whip in organizing the Democrats to line up for the Iran deal and behind the Women, Peace, and Security Act. But you have these new freshman women, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Omar Ilhan. We have Pramila Jayapal, and we have Deb Haaland, you know, the first Native American woman who is on the Armed Services Committee. This is a significant move, I think, to prevent when Trump comes home with this peace agreement, his peace or declaration of peace, that it won't be scuttled by the Democrats. Because let's not forget, I mean, the Democrats may say it's payback time, because in 1994, when Clinton negotiated the Green Framework with Kim Il-sung, or Kim Jong-il at the time, what happened. But he faced a Republican Congress that wouldn't put forth the funds to pay for the light water reactors that were part of the deal. So I think we're seeing a deja vu situation again, and hopefully we'll be able to counter that with some progressive Democrats that say, wait a minute, this is bigger than partisan politics. This is 9 out of 10 South Koreans, our key ally in the region, that wants an end to this war, that wants peace. This is good for America. If we ever want to see the kinds of things that this new Congress wants to achieve, Medicare for all, a new Green Deal, free college tuition, we must address the military budget, the $700 billion we spend annually, and the Korean War, and ending the Korean War. I mean, think about the Pacific Command. It's all oriented. We know really China, but North Korea has been a huge focus. If we take that conflict off the table, what does that mean for how we can reorient the priorities of our nation? I think this is a huge opportunity for America. We have to get beyond partisan politics. This is a great thing. And that's the message that we're here as women from around the world.
So, Brian, a group of about 20 members of the House of Representatives, they were all Democrats, on Tuesday, they introduced a resolution that would do what Christine Ahn was just talking about, formally end the Korean War, which had been, you know, a frozen conflict for 65, 66 years. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, this is a measure introduced in the House by Ro Khanna. It's very noteworthy. And Christine Ahn, of course, again, because she's well-regarded both in the U.S. Congress and in the South Korean government, she knows what she's talking about. These Congress people representing a fresh progressive current are saying, look, Donald Trump, even though we may oppose his policies on almost everything else, is doing something that needs to be supported by a measure in the House of Representatives, and that then, of course, a concurrent measure in the U.S. Senate that would bring the Korean War to an end, precisely for the reason that otherwise, if it's not done congressionally, if it's not codified with congressional action, it can be easily reversed. We know most of the political establishment and most of the people running for president in 2020, as of now anyway, would have a position that would be quite contrary to where Donald Trump is going, at least in regard to possible rapprochement with North Korea. Not rapprochement, because it's never happened before. The beginning of a reconciliation with the DPRK would be more precise. So that's a very important measure. I'd say this. People around the United States who care about peace, who want the two Koreas to be able to live in peace, who think the Korean War should come to an end, who don't like the fact that America spends $1 trillion a year on war for the feeding, the military-industrial complex, the war machine, all of which became a permanent feature of American life with the Korean War starting in June 1950. All the people who think those thoughts and believe those things, they should swing into action right now to support these kind of efforts to demand that the U.S. government end this war. You know, demonizing the DPRK maybe makes good headlines, but it just is a pretext, I would say an unpardonable, unconscionable pretext to maintain a sanctions regime which uses food and weapon against innocent people as a device to carry out regime change. There needs to be a new day on the Korean Peninsula, but the problem isn't in Pyongyang and it's not in Seoul. The problem has been in Washington, D.C. So we, the people in the United States, we need to do something about it.
Brian, I think you're exactly right. And with that said, today on the morning talk shows, we saw the likes of Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Madeleine Albright, who actually carried out negotiations with the North Koreans, saying that this policy is doomed, that it's going to weaken our country, that we're turning our backs on our South Korean friends and allies, and that it's doomed to fail. It's going to make us a weaker country if we make peace with the North Koreans. Do you think that that's going to be the line that the Democratic Party carries? Or do you think that the Democrats will eventually come around and support peace with the North?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that the problem is the establishment, Democratic and Republican. So if there are progressive individuals like these 20 people or 18 people who introduced and supported or sponsored this House measure who are not part of the Democratic Party traditional establishment, therein lies hope. You know, for a long time, John, people said you can never end the Vietnam War. I mean, that's what I heard the whole time I was growing up. If we end the war in Vietnam, it'll be a bloodbath. It'll be a catastrophe. The sky will fall. Guess what? When the war ended and peace came and Vietnam stopped suffering, it stopped bleeding. And we have to reject these kind of notions that are repeated over and over again ad nauseum by the establishment who want to wreck the prospects of peace. They might want to wreck it because it's Donald Trump who's driving it. They might want to wreck it because it defunds or takes away the pretext for the military-industrial complex. Whatever the reason is, they're bad reasons, and we have to reject it. Can peace come to Korea? Well, yes, it can. It came in Vietnam. The United States fought a longer war with Vietnam. 58,000 Americans died, 2 million Vietnamese died, and yet the United States is at peace with Vietnam. Why can't it be true for Korea as well?
We're out of time, but we're going to check in with Brian again tomorrow. We were joined from Hanoi by our own Brian Becker. He's there covering the summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Former attorney for President Trump, Michael Cohen, testified in open session before the House Oversight Committee today. He submitted documents to the committee, including copies of hush money checks that Trump wrote to him, financial documents, and emails. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted, this testimony had a little bit for everybody. I mean, there was so much of it that is headline worthy. Where do we even start?
Well, I think, you know, the meta, I always like the meta. And the meta is, for me, the utter contempt between the Democrats and the Republicans on the committee. I have seen fireworks on Capitol Hill before. I have been watching these hearings since the early 70s when I was a young political geek kid. But this is just, it's a new level of, Democrats and Republicans living in alternative realities. And they very plainly despise each other. There's no pretense of civility. To me, that's where I start.
So there are sort of two things going on. Like, on the one hand, we're learning juicy details about Donald Trump. You know, well, I mean, it depends on whether or not you believe what Cohen's saying, but certainly some of this stuff sounds plausible. And then there's the more substantive, possibly more substantive thing about Roger Stone and WikiLeaks. Which one of those two do you think are going to capture the headlines? I mean, is this going to remain sort of a gossip session, or is this going to have some sort of real effect on the course of the Mueller investigation?
Well, first of all, I think obviously the Mueller team already knows everything that Cohen is saying here. So there's no effect. There's not going to be any effect. It's like the stock market reacting to a report that they already knew about. It's already baked in. But in terms of the media coverage and this and the awareness of the American people, I think this is the moment where, as Richard Nixon would say, the American people look at their president and decide that, yeah, he's a crook. And the question, and there's no turning away from it or denying it. And it even does boil down to the little things like lying about bone spurs in the to avoid service in Vietnam, ordering his Michael Cohen not to release his college transcripts to anyone because apparently his grades aren't something he's particularly proud about at University of Pennsylvania and Fordham. So that stuff, it's about spinning an entire narrative. Now, clearly, if there's a gotcha moment here, it is about the WikiLeaks. It sounds like hearsay to me, though. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't see how there's this. This is not a smoking gun to me. It's sort of smoldering-ish, I would say.
You know, I'm struck, too, by how willing Cohen has been to stand up to mostly Republican members of this committee. There was an exchange between Cohen and Representative Jim Jordan in which Jordan mischaracterized, really, Cohen's testimony. Jordan said that Cohen's instinct was to blame others. He said, quote, "Your instinct to blame others is strong." And he said that he was disappointed that Cohen wasn't remorseful for some of the things that he did and said. Cohen interrupted him and said, "Shame on you, Mr. Jordan. That's not what I said. Shame on you." You don't see that every day in congressional hearings, do you?
You should. but you don't. You should, because it's great to have those no BS moments. And look, Cohen was right. It was a complete lie. And, you know, it's really weird when you see someone lie about something that you just witnessed a few minutes earlier. I mean, Michael Cohen came in there flogging himself, you know, like he was in some medieval ritual. He's certain, whatever else he is, credible or not credible, despicable or a hero, depending on your point of view, he certainly has been expressing remorse.
To basically all of the accusations made by Cohen today, the Republicans have the same retort, which is that, well, Michael Cohen is going to prison for lying, right? In fact, lying to Congress. And therefore, basically anything he says is not believable. It's not trustworthy. You can't form an opinion on that basis. Do you think that's going to be an effective argument in terms of public opinion?
I think it's going to work with the base. The base really is still in for the long run. And I think, it's a defense attorney's argument that we've seen in TV procedurals. You know, you flip a witness, the witness is willing to lie in order to avoid prison time, blah, blah, blah. In this case, however, Cohen didn't avoid prison time. As always, this is about what people in the middle who aren't really quite sure how they feel about Donald Trump come down. And I think, you know, to me, the real smoking gun moment is really that check from Donald Trump to Michael Cohen for $130,000 in order to compensate him for the money that, for the longest time, the administration claimed and the campaign claimed Cohen, out of the goodness of his heart, had taken a home equity loan out in order to pay to Stormy Daniels. That didn't pass the smell test at the time. And here, you know, here's this visual that's going to be on the front page of newspapers for those who still read them, and it's going to be all over the internet later today. And that's just really hard to avoid. You can't run from that check. I mean, that check shows violation of campaign finance law. I mean, it does. And whether that's impeachable or not is another question.
And that was the original accusation. The original accusation was that this was a campaign finance issue. And they denied and denied and denied. And now how are they going to deny it?
They can't. I mean, there's that famous signature on that check, you know, that iconic Trump signature that he loves to show off for the cameras. There's just no getting around it. I mean, the president absolutely broke the law. The question is now, is he going to pay any price for it?
Yeah. Yeah, I have to agree.
Well, this isn't going to be the only day that Michael Cohen is testifying before Congress. He's also going to be on Capitol Hill tomorrow. Yesterday, he was also testifying, but behind closed doors. Is this sort of the tail end of the Mueller investigation? It seems that some of the lawyers that have been working on the Mueller team are now being reassigned or returning to their old positions. Is this sort of a finale, or could this be... could this open the door to some sort of second stage of the investigations, perhaps this time led by congressional committees?
I'm going to weasel and say both. I think unless there's some startling new development, this is the beginning of the Mueller investigation is clearly winding down.
Yes.
And a report will be forthcoming. But the only thing that, you know, the reason I'm weaseling is because you just never know. I mean, someone could be out there who has information, who's witnessing all this, and this often happens in these kind of public hearings. A story gets out, it gets talked about more. Someone who's been sitting on information or evidence suddenly says, okay, all right, now I want to get involved. Now it's a big thing. Now that it's playing out a certain way, I'd like to affect the outcome. So that could cause things to be prolonged, but who knows?
Ted, we have to assume that none of this testimony is new to Robert Mueller and his team. We have to assume that Cohen has already told the Mueller team all the same stuff that he's telling the committees over these 3 days.
Absolutely.
The press is saying that if what Cohen is saying is true, that Trump may have committed obstruction of justice after all. Do you think that that matters in the greater scheme of things with this debate that apparently is taking place about whether or not you can actually charge a sitting president with a crime? Does it really matter if there's been obstruction?
Well, it should, but I like the way you ask that, and because my ear to the ground in online and in person political debates is that obstruction of justice is what a lawyer would call no longer a winning argument. In other words, it's a crime. It's impeachable. Nixon was going to be impeached for it. It was, I believe, in an article of impeachment in the Clinton impeachment, but it's not something that the American people seem to much care about, or it doesn't seem to resonate with them. So it may not really matter.
Ted, you're in New York City. You've been following Donald Trump for a long time. You also just are familiar, of course, with how the real estate world works in New York City and big real estate moguls like Donald Trump. I mean, are you surprised at any of these sort of shady dealings that Cohen is revealing here? Because, I mean, it seems like that's sort of the only, that's kind of the new stuff that the public is learning, right? I mean, the thing about Roger Stone and WikiLeaks, I mean, it's like one half of an overheard conversation that you just have to take Michael Cohen. Like, that doesn't seem very, like, strong, but this other stuff also doesn't seem that surprising, honestly, to me.
No, it's not surprising to anyone who knows anything about real estate at all, and or the Trump Organization. No, I mean, you know, we on this show we've said before, I think, that it's just corruption is probably a virtual certainty. Collusion, we're still waiting for the proof of that, right? So the corruption angle here is not at all shocking. The fixing, the threats, the obstruction, the witness tampering, all that stuff that's just standard landlord, gross developer, New York City real estate gangster politics. It's just the way business is done, and it's not just Donald Trump, obviously.
So what's the next step for Cohen? He's supposed to be sentenced, is it March the 9th or May the 9th? It was delayed, I remember, just so he could participate in these hearings. But what does he get out of these hearings? Has he been promised anything? Does this benefit him in any way?
I think he's kind of the Albert Speer of the Trump administration cronies who have faced criminal charges here. Albert Speer in the Nuremberg trials threw himself at the mercy of the court, admitted that he was a scoundrel, cleverly managed to evade taking responsibility for the Holocaust and war crimes, but admitted that he was a bad dude who knew he was doing bad things and apologized to the court, and then didn't get hung. He got 20 years in Spandau prison. That's the Michael Cohen route. I don't think he's been promised anything. There may have been perhaps an implied promise, which, from a prosecutor, you can't trust at all and shouldn't trust if you're ever in that situation. But I doubt it. I think my impression here is he's genuinely pissed off at Trump. And I would say, first and foremost, for not offering to pardon him and protect him. He thinks, here it is, I did all this stuff for this billionaire. I got paid a tiny fraction of what he got paid. I took the fall, and he let me take the fall. And a good mob boss would have watched my back, and he didn't catch me when I fell. So to hell with him. I'm going to rat him out. I'm going to expose him as much as I can. And I think this is about revenge more than anything else. And it's also about possibly going down the line, knowing that when he gets out of prison, he might have a job waiting for him as a pundit somewhere on MSNBC or Fox or something like that, probably MSNBC, and knowing that he'll get some credibility. He could kind of go the Elliot Spitzer route and be rehabilitated and redeemed, which in American politics happens very quickly.
Bill Clinton, for instance.
Yep.
You know, we have just about a minute left. Part of the exchange between Representative Jim Jordan and Michael Cohen revolves around this question of, well, was Cohen just bitter because he didn't get a prominent position in the Trump administration? And, you know, Cohen saying, oh, well, I was offered a job. I could have worked with Don McGahn at the general counsel's office, which, of course, I don't know, that seems like a pretty humiliatingly low rank for him. I don't know. I mean, do you think there's anything to it that this sort of comes down to Cohen not getting the reward that he thought he was entitled to after the victory in the 2016 campaign?
You know, who knows what Michael Cohen's really thinking in his heart of hearts. But frankly, it sounded ridiculous to me that that's what motivated him. I mean, you know, putting yourself into Cohen's point of view, I think it's exactly what I said. I think it wasn't careerism or resentment at being passed over for a prominent White House position. A lot of people have been power brokers within White Houses, like Dick Morris was under Clinton, without being a member of the White House staff. And it doesn't matter. In fact, it might be better, really, in many ways, because you don't attract as much attention. And Cohen was always happy to be behind the scenes. He never wanted to be front and center like Roger Stone. He's not that kind of showboater. He's a fixer behind the scenes. That's his personality. That's his demeanor. That's how he presents. And so I really think this is about, boss, I did everything for you. I paid off your porn star that you had an affair with, and I did everything for you, and I risked everything, and you didn't watch my back.
That's the bottom line right there. He also really, really hated being called a rat. We're going to leave it there, though. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Check out his work at www.rall.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Pakistan's armed forces said they shot down two Indian fighter aircraft in Pakistani airspace on Wednesday. At the same time, India claimed it downed a Pakistani jet over its territory and lost one of its own planes in the process. Are we headed toward another war in South Asia? We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Weinbaum, we had a very similar conversation yesterday, and to tell you the truth, I kind of thought that both sides would back off. Yesterday, we saw, for the first time in a half a century, Indian airstrikes in Pakistani territory, and I'm not an expert, of course, but I believed that both sides would just take a step back and say, well, we can work this out diplomatically. At least as of today, they're not working this out diplomatically. Are we going to see a continuing worsening of the situation along the border there?
Well, this certainly, the possibility of that has increased dramatically from Tuesday to Wednesday. On Tuesday, India claimed that it had successfully hit camps, terrorist camps, and that it was satisfied with that. And Pakistan was given the option of saying, well, you know, it happened that you did cross the border, and for that you're going to pay. But nothing really seriously happened. Nobody was killed. Nothing worth our effectively saying, we'll respond. But I think every anticipation then that it would be a token response. Wednesday changes the picture, because then we have a loss of life. We see here that there is a serious follow-up. Now, why was there a follow-up? It may very well be that Pakistan was very effective in saying what you did amounted to nothing, and India, therefore, could not save face as it had hoped, and it had to do something additionally. And so it was prompted then to have still a follow-up, which would be a tougher kind of punishment for Pakistan and its support of this group, Jaish-e Mohammed. But now, whereas it would have been a token response, now I think there's every reason to believe that Pakistan will strike back much more aggressively than it was before, and that indeed is what puts us on this ladder, particularly because then what we may see is striking at military installations or concentrations of soldiers on both sides, and that's going to be difficult. Let me say that I think the only thing we have strongly going for us is an indication that the leadership on both sides recognizes the danger of this. And that's really what we're banking on. Because whereas in the past we could depend on outside mediation, and particularly the United States, that's not likely to happen for a number of reasons. On the U.S. side, we don't have the diplomats there who can do what we did very effectively in the past, and particularly in 2002, when we headed off a major confrontation. And I was in the State Department at the time, and I know how close we came to seeing that and how important a diplomacy can be if it's in the hand of a skilled mediator. But let me just say that also, now we have less leverage over Pakistan. We have cut our aid to Pakistan. We have in Pakistan a prime minister who is much less inclined to look on Washington favorably. He's been critical of Washington. So those factors really, I think, lessen the possibility here that others are going to save those two countries from themselves. I think they're going to have to do that for themselves.
How much do domestic political calculations come into play when it comes to both the actions of the Indian government and the Pakistani government? I mean, there's...
On both sides, particularly on the Indian side, with an election pending in April. That was certainly a factor here. Imran Khan's initial response was one of saying, look, let's be careful of what we're doing here. We will respond if you do anything more serious, which was what subsequently India did in sending over, I believe it was something like 12 planes, and striking inside Pakistan proper. So we're seeing here the public coming into play. It's always going to be a factor. You know, these are democracies in their own way, and they can't ignore these pressures. And also remember, it's not just pressures from the public; it's pressures from their military. That counts a great deal in Pakistan, perhaps less so in India. But that's real too.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned 2002. I happened to be serving in Pakistan in 2002 when the two countries really did walk right up to the brink of a nuclear exchange. And then Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage flew out to mediate, and both sides backed off. I have to say, I think you're exactly right that we just don't have that kind of diplomatic firepower right now to pull both sides back. I'm looking at a piece in the Hill newspaper today, and it says that perhaps the threat of a nuclear war between India and Pakistan is a little overblown. It says that Pakistan's military really fears an Indian Army conventional war or an attack that would allow it to seize Lahore, which is practically walking distance from the Indian border. Do you see that as a possibility where Indian troops could actually cross the border into Pakistan?
I think they would have crossed the red line. Pakistan has made it very clear that any Indian intrusion on the ground that struck a vital entity in Pakistan would threaten Pakistan's integrity. Certainly Lahore, which is the second most important city in the country, this would be something to which Pakistan would unquestionably respond to in the strongest possible fashion. So I think that the Hill here is engaged in wishful thinking here. I think both sides recognize this factor. The other possibility is that India would mount a campaign from Rajasthan and come in really south of that, and that would ultimately threaten the lifeline to Karachi, which is the country's major city. If nuclear weapons did not exist, I don't believe there's any doubt that India would consider these kinds of moves, but nuclear weapons changes the picture. And again, I say that the leadership on both sides is aware of this. That's no guarantee that they won't go, blindly here or against their own wishes when things really heat up and they feel that their sovereignty has been challenged. So I would not take any comfort in the fact that they would allow the kind of actions that the Hill is talking about. Just doesn't make sense to me.
Could mediation come from a country other than the United States? I mean, China, for instance, has very close relations with Pakistan. And even though China-India ties are strained at certain times, there is definitely a diplomatic relationship there as well.
Yes, it's been a developing relationship. And I think that China, together with the United States, and that happened in the Cargill case in 1999, where the idea was to get Pakistan to then withdraw its troops after it had intruded into mountainous areas in India. The combination of China and the United States got the then Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif was Prime Minister at that time, to back off. China can play a role, but the role would be to really their leverage with Pakistan, much more than any influence they would have with India. They've got an enormous investment in Pakistan now, and the last thing they want to see is a conflict in that region, which would undermine their Road and Belt initiative. It would totally throw that off. And then we've got beyond that the consequences of, depending on the scale of a nuclear exchange, the environmental consequences, which are catastrophic, and not just for South Asia, for much of the globe.
Over the last couple of weeks, the relations between the two countries have been worsening, besides the fact that the Indians bombed this Jaish-e-Mohammed camp in Kashmir. But there was a pause, and that was when Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman visited both countries. The visit, by all accounts, went very well, both to Pakistan and India. Do you think that there's a role for the Saudis here to try to mediate?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I do think that in some ways Saudi Arabia may be even more important than the United States and China at this point. It has, of course, close ties to Pakistan. But interestingly, it has always maintained good relations with India. It has an economic relationship with India in recognition of the fact that India is the economic giant in South Asia. And both of these countries are energy dependent. So, yes, I think that particularly on the fact that MBS has just recently been there, he could play a constructive role, but it'll be a diplomatic role. If the countries get into a mood here where they are retaliating, responding to the other, and they're faced with, say, the particular decision on whether to use tactical nuclear weapons or not, these decisions will, of course, be made by the leaders themselves and their militaries. This is something that the other countries are not going to be able to stop them from doing. They've got to be the restraint on that. They can help them find a way out of this, but are not going to dictate what methods they use if they're engaged in conflict.
We have just about a minute left. Kashmir, which the suicide bombing in Kashmir about a week ago sort of set off this chain of events that we're talking about now. But another source of tension between India and Pakistan is Afghanistan and the different armed groups that are operating there. Just fill us in on that.
These events are going to simply turn Pakistan away from what's going on in the negotiations. Anyway, they played their role. Their role was to get the Taliban to go to the table. I believe that beyond that, they have very little role to play. At this point, the Taliban will decide what, if anything, it wants to do in the way of accommodating American demands here, which match their demands. Let me just add finally that there's another element here, and that's water. There's a severe drought, the whole region, and water here is a weapon that India could use against Pakistan with great consequences for Pakistan.
Indeed. Well, we were very pleased to be joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Walter Smolarek. Venezuela's self-declared President Juan Guaido said today that he will begin exercising his, quote, presidential duties, unquote, as soon as he returns to Venezuela from Colombia, where he met with Vice President Pence and Colombian President Iván Duque. Meanwhile, the diplomatic tide appears to be turning in favor of President Maduro as several countries vigorously opposed foreign intervention at the UN Security Council and a major pro-government international civil society conference is being held in Caracas. We're joined from Caracas by Anya Parampil. She's a Washington-based journalist for the Gray Zone Project. Welcome, Anya.
Thanks for having me.
Anya, it is literally impossible to determine from the American press what things are really like on the ground in Venezuela. You've been there for some weeks now. Can you tell us what daily life is like?
Well, the first thing is we hear constantly in Western media that there's a humanitarian crisis on the ground right now in Venezuela. And so far, I've been here for over 2 weeks now. I haven't seen any evidence of that. I've seen an economic crisis for sure, which, you know, we could talk about the roots of that. But they're really, this economic crisis has been caused by a prolonged economic war that's been waged on this country by Washington and you know, resulted in the decline in the buying power of Venezuelans. The Bolivar is almost worthless up against the dollar right now. So much of the economy here is relying on the dollar, dollarized. You can pay for goods using U.S. currency, which is only making the problem even worse. And so when you walk into stores or you walk down the street, you can see plenty of food available for purchase. But the average Venezuelan can't always afford some of these products because the prices are so high. There are no price controls. And inflation has really hurt their ability to use their currency to buy basic things. But at the same time, the government does have programs like the CLAP program, which services 6 million households and actually delivers staples goods like oil and beans and pasta to families every month. In fact, the government here, the Maduro government, just announced they plan to deliver clap boxes every 15 days, so twice a month. So there is an effort here on the part of the government to address that crisis. And it should also just be emphasized that despite what you hear in Western media, there is no doubt here in Caracas as to who's governing Venezuela. And it's the Maduro government, not Juan Guaido.
Not Juan Guaido. I wanted to point out to you two pieces that ran today. One at Fox News and the other at Bloomberg, and they kind of echo each other. I wanted to get your reaction. At Fox News, they're saying that Venezuelan soldiers choose desertion over being powerless and being attacked, and that they're running away from Maduro. We've not seen that in the international press, only in the U.S. press. There's also a piece in Bloomberg saying that as time passes, Guaido has time and Maduro doesn't have time. That as long as this drags out longer, it weakens Maduro and it strengthens Guaido. Would you agree with either one of those positions?
I think this is real panic on the part of the press in the States to hold on to this dream that Guaido's somehow going to end up governing the country here. I mean, it was kind of entertaining over the weekend to watch Marco Rubio try and count the number of Venezuelan soldiers that were defecting. 1 minute he would tweet 26 soldiers have now left Maduro's military, and now it's 100. But these are very small numbers, and no one really significant has switched. I mean, that's why there hasn't been a change in the government. The military has stood by the constitutional leader of the country, Nicolas Maduro, and you know, they've been able to pick a few people off. Or, you know, there was Saturday, there was actually an incident in which two deserters drove their military trucks across the bridge right where Venezuela meets Colombia and actually hit or drove right towards a group of civilians and journalists that were there covering the U.S. attempt to bring in humanitarian aid. They injured a Chilean journalist and then ran across the other side and were greeted by Colombian authorities who said, these are ours. Don't worry. Let them across. So there's definitely been efforts to make soldiers switch, and it's resulted in some really frightening acts that we saw and danger, but there's still no real shift. And that's why on Sunday, the Venezuelan government was able to face down an attempted U.S. military invasion. I mean, we shouldn't mince words here. That's really what we know the U.S. was trying to do, and they failed. And so for U.S. media to be claiming the military is slowly switching sides, is a bit absurd when we saw the opposite happen.
And what about some of the pro-government, anti-intervention mobilizations? I mean, it seems from afar that they've been quite large. Have you had a chance to go to any? And do you have a sense of the direction that things are going? Are the mobilizations, the marches, the rallies in support of the Maduro government getting larger or smaller?
Well, they seem to be very strong. I haven't been able to see any of them outside of Caracas, though I've seen the same images I'm sure you have, where thousands, if not hundreds of thousands and millions of people have taken to the streets around the country throughout the last several weeks to show their support for the government. Here in Caracas, I had a chance to, I visited Plaza Bolivar, where the government was collecting signatures from Venezuelans, signing a letter denouncing U.S. intervention in their country. And I filed a report for the Gray Zone about it and just interviewed people who were waiting in line. And these were, I mean, I saw thousands of people in one afternoon waiting in line for hours to sign this letter. And they were doing that completely on their own free will because they realize what's at stake here. If the U.S. has its way and the Guaido gang is able to take over Caracas, the people who live here, who for the last 20 years have actually been included in their society and made, you know, very important economic and social gains, they will be erased once again, and the country will only belong to the elite. And that's really the message that I got from speaking to people, and they understand why they're experiencing this economic crisis. They don't blame the government. They're very aware that sanctions and what's really an embargo of Venezuela at this point, led by the United States, is what's leading to their harm. And so they believe less U.S. intervention and not more is the solution.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Anya Perrenpil. She is a journalist with the Gray Zone Project. She's in Caracas. You know, after Mike Pence declared that Juan Guaido was the president of Venezuela, the United States was able to get a number of its allies, right-wing governments in Latin America and around the world, including Israel, to recognize Guaido also as, you know, the president of Venezuela. But there's also been a large solidarity movement that's emerged around the world, including here in the United States. For instance, on March 16th, there'll be a major mobilization against war on Venezuela in front of the White House. In Caracas, there is an International Assembly of Civil Society Activists going on. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they've been planning this International Assembly for about 2 years now, a year and a half. And so when this all began, they had no idea that it would happen to coincide with an attempted U.S. coup against the Maduro government. And I actually went to a speech yesterday delivered by President Maduro addressing this crowd of delegates from countries all over the world. And he said, you know, when they told me that they wanted to put this on in May of 2017 and that they wanted to do it in February 2019, I said, February what? Because at that point in 2017, the opposition was again engaged in a violent campaign in the streets to overthrow the government. And so he said something along the lines of, we resisted that then, and we've still resisted it. Look at us now. I mean, that what they've been able to achieve in that time frame has actually only confirmed the support that the government has here. And the fact that this group of international delegates came to Caracas at this time, I think, underscores the international solidarity that Venezuela is receiving right now, but it's not happening only here. I know in New York as well, Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza has created a group of over 60 countries at the United Nations, which are not only standing in solidarity with Venezuela, but reasserting the importance of the UN's founding principles, sovereignty, self-determination, and territorial integrity. And I think because of the way the Trump administration has gone about this coup in such a brazen way and, you know, tried to actually stage a propaganda stunt on the border in order to justify military intervention, this is all happening in a way that's very different from previous regime change operations we experienced with Syria and Libya, although there are similarities, of course, when it comes to media deception. But it hasn't been as successful as previous attempts. And especially, like I say, even here in Caracas, the opposition doesn't question that Maduro is currently governing the country. And I should say, not only have protests from on the pro-government side gotten stronger here, but I've noticed I've been to two opposition rallies now, and those demonstrations have just gotten extremely weak. I mean, very unorganized. They were addressed by Maria Corina Machado, a right-wing lawmaker here who's called for U.S. military intervention. That's because their supposed leader, Juan Guaido, has abandoned them to be in Colombia and, you know, hang out with Mike Pence and Elliot Abrams. So there's a real crisis, it seems, on the opposition side, while at the same time the government in Venezuela is getting very strong international support from activists, from people who have traveled here as citizens from other countries, but also delegates and representatives at the United Nations. And I think that's very important because we've never really seen something like that happen before.
Anya, are we seeing the proverbial irresistible force meeting an immovable object, or is there some kind of a negotiated way that the Venezuelans can settle this issue of Maduro and Guaido? Is Maduro going to remain as the president of Venezuela, the democratically elected president of Venezuela, or is the United States going to be successful in imposing Guaido and essentially overthrowing the Venezuelan government?
Well, it's hard to predict, but my personal sense, and from speaking to people in government here, is that they do believe a political solution is possible, but there won't be a change in government without U.S. military intervention. And that's not even what people who I speak to in official government positions say. It's what people on the streets say. There's a huge popular support for the government, and those people are saying they're willing to fight and die to protect what they've achieved here over the last 20 years. So I don't think, unless the United States is willing to go that far, I do not believe you will see a situation in which Juan Guaido in any real tangible way begins governing here. I mean, so far they seem more interested in appearing as though they're like president on Twitter or something. That's really how I feel, considering Guaido's presidency was announced via Twitter from Donald Trump. And I don't know if you followed what happened in the Costa Rican embassy, Venezuela's Costa Rican embassy in Costa Rica, but it was very interesting because you had a situation in which a woman claiming to represent Guaido's government bribed the owner of the building to let her in overnight and then declared herself the diplomatic representative in San Jose. And what ended up happening is the Costa Rican government, which is very already recognized the Guaido government, actually rejected that and said this is a flagrant violation of international norms and laws.
We will see a lot more of that, I suspect. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're out of time. That was the voice of Anya Parampil, who joined us from Caracas. She's a Washington-based journalist for the Gray Zone Project. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.